Good evening.
Good evening.
I'm Dr. Tatum, and I'm 40. I wanted joining that line there. So that means I've been in education half my life now, for about 20 years. I started off as a finance major. I wanted to make a lot of money. I was a business major at Northern Illinois University. But I read an article that chronicled the failures of African-American boys, and on that day I went over to the College of Education, and I thought I was just going to do this for about 5 years, and I've been in education ever since. It's an honor to be here tonight with AAA, the African-American Academy for Accelerated Learning. But when I think about the role of education for our young people particularly, I'm really thinking about accelerated living, which is correlated with accelerated learning. So I often talk about reading and writing for their lives and addressing the literacy needs of students of color. But I want to start here. The failure and the underperformance of African-American children is not natural. It never has been, it never will be. But somehow it has become normalized in the United States of America. We've had this reading achievement gap and life outcome gap for more than 40 years. So I'm here to suggest that, you said one thing that we can do, I'm here to suggest that we must actively seek to destroy everything that goes against the manifestation of the human dignity of our children. And secondly, we must refuse to cooperate in the degradation of their humanity. The challenge is, America has no clear and consistent remedy for educating its darkest children. We are handicapped. Everywhere we go in the nation, people are trying different things, but oftentimes we are missing the mark. So for the past 17 years, I've been trying to help us rethink what it means to teach reading, particularly in writing, for African-American children. But oftentimes there is this imbalance. And I know there are many African-Americans who are doing extremely well, but my litmus test is by those who live in communities of turmoil. I cannot be satisfied if I'm succeeding and there are others who are having their humanity soured. There's this imbalance I want to talk about. Many of our young children experience this out-of-school literacy overload. And you know what I'm talking about. A lot of things that are going on, maybe poverty, poor parenting, a wide range of effects. But we have to make sure that they do not experience an in-school literacy underload. Students often lack sufficient text in schools that help them critique, respond, and move beyond the text on the outside of schools. And this is where you have the manifestation of the life outcome gap. And I'm juggling two computers here at the same time. I've never done this before. Okay. Oh, I have to push the button on this computer. There we go. I have it now, I think. But I'm a praying man. If not, I'll invoke my spirituality. And we'll get through this together. But when I talk about African-American children particularly, there's this triple threat that exists, particularly those who struggle. They just give up. Sometimes it's students, parents, and educators. They get tired of trying. This can be students, parents, and educators, or they become despondent and pessimistic about our ability to succeed. That can be a combination of students, parents, and educators. So my interest is, how do we begin to move beyond this triple threat? I want to share a quote with you. I was talking to an African-American gentleman, early 40s, and I said, what do we need to do to help our young brothers recover? And he says, Brother Tatum, I have your solution. He said, we need to dig a hole large enough for 10 million of these young men, advertise free government link cards to attract them and some of their parents to the hole, and put a lid on the hole before setting it on fire. That is the ultimate form of despondency. I hear this all the time, where we shift the culpability to our young children who are suffering. who have these, who are neglected or have some sense of social devastation. Well, I'm here to tell you, I'm always hopeful when young people show up, because the hope is in their presence. If they appear before us, that means they are giving us the opportunity. There's a Swiss theologian who said this, illicitum non sparidum. And what that means in Latin is, we are not allowed not to hope. Let me repeat that. Illicitum non sparidum means we are not allowed not to hope. I want to share a conversation with a young male. And this is why I shared that previous quote. Every time someone comes to my reading clinic, I ask one fundamental question. I say, who are you? And this is the response of a young male. He says, I don't know. I said, what do you want to be when you get old? He says, what? I said, how long do you want to live, huh? See, I live in a city where 83 children were murdered last year. And we've already lost 7 this year. So you can begin to see the context, what I mean by the out-of-school literacy overload. I said, do you love yourself? Nope. I says, why not? I just don't. Do you care about these questions I'm asking, young brother? He says, not really. So I says, well, why are you here today? He says, my mother made me. I said, what do you see when you look in the mirror? I see me. Who are you? I'm Daquan. I said, what does that mean? He said, it don't mean nothing. I say, Daquan means nothing? There was no response. I said, how old are you? He says, I'm 10. How could you arrive at a place and space this early in your life and find out or find a way not to love who you are? So this doesn't require a theoretical response. This requires a response wrapped in an ethic of love, an ethic of care, and an ethic of competence. So I want to share another piece from my writing institute this summer, because I'm giving brothers the power of the pen to express themselves, because I want to make sure that this generation can mark their times and mark their lives with their own words. So he wrote a piece called The Wind You Can Feel. He says, you can take my life and my mind too. You don't have to take my heart, I'm giving it to you. But the one thing you will never get is my pen, because without it, I'm nothing. Writing is the only thing I have left. Now, when I met this guy, this is the second week we were together, when I met this guy, he had an aversion for writing. He did not understand the power of his pen. See, Brother W.E.B. Du Bois said this a long time ago. When a human being becomes suddenly conscious of the tremendous powers lying latent within him, when from the puzzled contemplation of a half-known self, he rises to the powerful assertion of self, conscious of its might, then there is loosed upon the world possibilities of good that make men pause. I wanted to see if I could have these young men discover the possibilities of good in their pens. Then he goes on, my mama don't like me. My family treats me like I was a person on the street. Most of my family never wants me by their kids. Isn't that something? I cannot go next to my cousin, so kill me. Let me roll over and die. But when I go, don't let my writing go with me. Let it stay with you. I know people are getting tired of reading about my blank life, because I am. I can't take it anymore. Someone kill me and get it over. I'd rather die and be remembered than live and be forgotten. Listen to that, teachers. So when I turn to dust, don't let my writing turn to ashes. I said, whoa, young brother, come here. Is that true? He said, every word I wrote is true. He's 11. Right? Talking about babies. Can't blame this on their mamas. I can't have limited self-efficacy. I can't give up or get tired of trying or become despondent and pessimistic about the ability to succeed. They need a courageous response. I'm going to juggle again. So one of the things I want to think about clearly are those curriculum orientations.
What we put in front of our young folks. Oftentimes what we put in front of African-American children miss the mark because we neglect to pay attention to their multiple identities. And the young man I work with begins to think about our ideology. So I wrote this poem. It's called Ideology, to sort of capture what I sense from African-American young brothers. You know, it strikes me. There's no ideology when it comes to educating me. See, our young people know when education is a lie. And we know when we're providing a lie to them. But somehow we don't have the courage to remove beyond those lies. We hide behind standards and research-based strategies and the national imagination to improve reading scores. It can be a lie. You would rather I read Shakespeare for the sake of Shakespeare's survival, not my own. I want to survive too. Shakespeare and I can coexist if you insist, but help me understand that I exist in this coexistence. Fight for my right. After all, I am still alive. Shakespeare's dead, you know that, right? I'm not sure if he even cared about me the way you want me to care for him. Will he help me get off the block? I have not been convinced that he is the answer, in part or fully, to the social ills plaguing young black brothers. But I will read Antigone if you give me a chance and show me how. I care about love, but I want to be loved too. It's hard to read about love in a loveless environment. I don't care who's writing. Your imprints upon my psyche, that's that legacy we were just talking about. Your imprints upon my psyche are just as real as the imprints on the page. I can't pay attention to one while you expect me to ignore the other. When it comes to educating me, strengthen the ideology. The next time someone wants to water down the curriculum and have me read some bullsh, stand on top of the table and shout, hell no. Let them know I am someone's child. When it comes to educating me, strengthen the ideology. Three final phrases to help you in this plight. Fight for my right to be. Fight for my right to be. Fight for my right to be. Just fight for me. Every time I fight, I seem to get in trouble. Fight for me. Shape a positive trajectory, please. Ah, Shakespeare. So what has this meant in my work? I want to use an analogy, particularly for the teachers and administrators who are in the room here. The medical profession has figured out four vital signs: blood pressure, pulse, weight, and temperature. They gauge that every time you go to the hospital. They don't care how much money you make, where you come from, who you are, because they know within those four vital signs they can identify if something is wrong with the patient. Well, we have vital signs in reading and writing as well. We have vital signs of reading that just says provide the working tools. That's column number one. Word knowledge, fluency, strategy knowledge, writing, language use. That's where we often have this reading achievement gap that has existed for more than 40 years. But many of our efforts have been localized in column number one. But we have vital signs of readers. And tonight we're talking about the African-American children, right? The vital signs of reading says, how do we improve the human condition? We have to pay attention to home life, culture, developmental culture, ethnic culture, gender culture, environment, language, and economics. The poet Leroy Jones has said, this is where we're getting down with the real stuff, right? That stuff in the first column is absolutely necessary. But when we begin to think about kids' life outcome trajectories, we have to begin to think about their multiple identities that they bring to the course or bring to our classes. And then we have to the vital signs of reading and writing instruction, because each of these variables can interrupt what happens with our young folks. What does quality instructional support look like for African-American children? See, my work doesn't just focus on African-American children. It's focused on all kids, including African-American children. Somehow our kids have been excluded in these large equations. So what types of texts should we begin to think about? or context or assessment and technology. That's where we have the rigor gap. And then W.E.B. Du Bois also said, let's stop interacting with our kids as if they're scorecards of achievement. That's how we differentiate young folks, by reading scores and writing scores. He said, and I'll let you know, my mama didn't give birth to a reading score. She gave birth to me in my full humanity. But somehow someone else projected that identity upon me. So this says a different level of competence, commitment, caring, and culpability. So this is what I wrote about in the book, Teaching Reading to Black Adolescent Males, how each of these variables are critically important for educating African-American children. Because we have to strive to make our instruction legitimate. All right. Usually culturally responsive educators, we don't necessarily deal with efficiency alone. We have to make it legitimate. Legitimacy engages students in different ways. It makes them want to hold on and hold out, particularly if I have some type of vulnerable experiencing conditions. So that's why I wrote this. And this goes with call number one. Neither effective reading strategies nor literacy reform efforts will close the life outcome gap, which is a larger gap, unless meaningful text are at the core of the curriculum and educators know how to mediate such text, giving attention to both reading and writing. And I had a wonderful conversation with a gentleman about the roles of text, and he directed me to a website, and I went and researched this website and started constructing these textual links that I'm going to talk about in short order. So I ask, when we think about our young brothers and sisters, particularly the ones who live in communities of turmoil or conditions of turmoil, can we place three different R's under consideration? Recovery, resilience, and reconciliation. And this is why. Limited reading skills cause students internal anguish. Right? The pain many of these students experience may cause them to openly state, as I heard on a documentary in Douglas High School in Baltimore, a young man says, F academics. That's for those nerdy MFs. I am going to keep it gutter. Right? This type of thinking cannot be interrupted by just providing those vital signs of reading. There is something deeper at work here. And we have to think deeply to counter a mindset that causes one to embrace the notion, I'm going to keep it gutter. And I'm going to let you know, even though we have an African-American male president, many students are still finding it difficult to recover. It's no magic bullet. We have to continue to do the hard work. President Obama is not a reading and writing teacher. The pain is internal, connected to them. I may be inspired. I may want to give it a shot and give it a chance. But I need someone at the class roots level that would open up those spaces and places for me. So one of the things that I began to do with young folks, and this is the one thing I continue to do in my work, I try to enable young folks using text. This is the opposite of disabling. Frederick Douglass wrote this a long time ago. I often found myself regretting my existence and wishing myself dead. And but for the hope of being free, I have no doubt I would have killed myself. This sounds just like the 10-year-old boy I just shared some text with you from. He thinks he's going this alone. Frederick Douglass already figured him out. But he suffers from an underexposure to text. And I'll tell you, this happens across the nation when I go into classrooms. This is the 40 state I've been into in this country, talking about literacy development in African-American males. Our young people are suffering from an underexposure to text because we find it difficult to mediate text with them. So we began to blame it on parenting and poverty, when the only thing that we're in control of is our pedagogy, right, and our compassion for young folks. I can't control that other stuff. And Frantz Fanon wrote this: resign yourself to your color the way I got used to my stump. He's a Caribbean-born philosopher, has skin the color of mine. But Frantz Fanon came back and says, nevertheless, with my strength, I refuse to accept that amputation. I feel in myself a soul as immense as the world, truly a soul as deep as the deepest rivers. My chest has the power to expand without limits. I am the master, and I'm advised to adopt the humility of the cripple. This is what we were reading for spelling instruction in my 8th grade classroom. And I only work with struggling readers. And on average, my kids made 3- and 4-year gains in 1 year. But I was trying to impregnate their thinking, something that would allow them to become resilient and hold on and hold out. That's why I have students Googling me on Facebook now. Are you Dr. Tatum from Mayo Elementary School? I remember we had to say the revolution begins in the year 2010. Arm yourself with intellect in the past and create change. 2010 is coming up, man. Well, see, this was in 1995, 1996. And I calculated 2010 to marriage with the time I think they would finish graduate school. So that's why we recited that every single day. So one of the vital pathways to help our young folks recover, become resilient, and reconcile to a new identity is building these things I call textual lineages, which was the focus of my second book. And I just want to give you a snippet of a textual lineage. I did this all the way back from Nat Turner all the way up to Tupac Shakur. Right? And every time someone introduced me to, I read a biography or autobiography, I construct these textual lineages to find out what allows someone to remain steadfast. So this is H. Rapp Brown, Stokely Carmichael, Elridge Cleaver, and Huey Newton. And they were reading all the same. Uh-oh, I didn't turn my thing around. You can't see what I'm seeing. Okay. Stay focused, Tatum. Stay focused. I'm invoking my spirituality now. All right. All right. Make sure you stay with me, Pastor. All right. Put your hand on me if you have to. All right. So here are these things called textual lineages. And I think this goes along with the song Legacy that we just heard this evening, how these texts impacted someone's psyche. So these African-American male were reading the same text across different environments. I wanted to figure out why. So what I began to do, I constructed my own textual lineage just from middle school and high school, the ones that teachers exposed me to in schools. See, I had teachers who had Harvard dreams for kids living in hellish conditions. It didn't matter to them that I was placed at gunpoint three times in my lifetime. They wanted me to move through the brook of that particular fire, right? So I went to 8th grade. I had a processed hairdo. It's called a Chicago curl. I couldn't afford the carefree curl at the time, right? Allowance $5, Chicago curl $2.99, carefree curl $3.99. Right? You do the math. I told you I was a finance major, right? So I appeared in my 8th grade classroom with this changed hairstyle. And this teacher gave me this book, the autobiography of Malcolm X. Stick book for an 8th grader. So I gave it a chance because some educator recognized my humanity. So I started reading about Detroit Red, the Zoot Suits, and the Conks. So I said, this lady's talking about my hair. Right? But I've never since had a processed hairdo. Right? Found a way to love myself through that text. Remember the young man says, I do not love me? That's why I ask, do you love yourself, to my young folks? Because there's this power in finding a way to love who you are. Right? You can't do that with a reading skill and strategy alone. So there, I have relationships with all of these particular texts. But here's the dichotomy. And we have power over this. We decide to put certain types of text in front of young folks. Enabling text moves you to be, do, and think differently as a result of you read. But these disabling texts can ignore all of those other identities that are kids important to classrooms. That's when we play around, look at kids as if their achievement scores, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All right? So that's my charge. How do we? And then, you know, if you think about enabling text, it can be biblical text. So our folks read the Bible, get power, strength, how to overcome a divorce, how to lose weight. All of these types of texts are what's characteristic enabling texts, because you're looking for some type of power in those texts. The same thing holds true with our young kids as well, but oftentimes we don't conceptualize it as such. But here's my writing lineage. High-performing student. My writing lineage is blank. Can't blame that on my mama. I showed up every day. I was there. I would have done anything you asked me to do. And I can conjugate verbs and subject-verb agreement, but somehow someone turned down the volume of text. I only remember writing one thing that I found meaningful and significant from K through 12. And that was my junior research paper. I was trying to bring the Ku Klux Klan down from the south side of Chicago. I became totally, totally invested. And this was the reason why I started my Summer Literacy Institute. I said, can we get these young brothers to write something that's meaningful and significant? All right? Next year, we're going to have one for the young ladies as well. But when I asked African-American children and other children to construct their textual lineages, it looks just like this. This is one of the greatest tragedies of American education. Right? And this is directly connected to the triple threat, because we haven't figured out how to mediate text with young folks. All right? So using those vital signs and thinking about instruction in different ways, I began to build kids' textual lineage with fiction, with literary and non-literary texts, in hopes that they can recover, become resilient, and reconcile to different identities. So I have over 3,000 of these that I began to pay attention to. So one of the things I always have to think about, where to start the text, thinking about my young folks' identities, how to introduce the text, how to frame with questions that students might find essential, how to connect the text to larger goals that will give it a sustaining quality. All right? I not only do this as a teacher, I do it as a parent. See, we have parents in here. Many of your kids are going to school and their textual lineages are being severed. Even the ones who are high performing, even the ones you're paying money for. All right? But they may have good grades. Is that the role of education? A good grade? Right? What about Paideia, a deep education, moving beyond the surface level? Right? It's a different type of orientation. And if we decide to move forward, there's no one can stop us because we have the power to define how we want to thrust education upon our students. And if we don't find the power and courage, we have to figure out, we have to somehow find that courage. Right? As an eighth grade teacher for the first 5 years, I listen to the same song every morning going to work. I'm a child of the 70s, Marvin Gaye. The song called Save the Children. Who really cares? Who is willing to try to save the world that is destined to die? Can I join the group now? My man said, nah, you can't join this group. You stay with that reading stuff, man. We're ahead of this. But again, I always, that was a question, who's willing to try? That was a question that I always said, I am. So that's why I always pray for the strength, the wisdom, and the advocacy to move forward in unapologetic ways, right? Sometimes we apologize about what we need to do for our children. Let's be unapologetic about it. This came out awful, so I'm going to skip this. And I'll give you two more points because it's getting late anyway. I have about 26 slides. If you want to gauge where I am, I'm on slide number 24. I didn't want to tell you that at the beginning because you've been counting down. But now that we're close to the end, just have a couple more to go. Right? That's what they do on Sunday. Right? And I know the Cleveland Cavaliers are playing tonight in New York City, so. But some type of interesting conversation has been taking place. And this came from my writing institute this summer. There's been this clarion call to take my America back, right? After President Obama became the president. We want our America back. But oftentimes, young folks don't have the language to defend that, so they just get angry, right? F that stuff, right? But I said, how do we get the language to not only define who we are and build and nurture resilience, but for someone else to build that capacity? So I wrote the piece, and this is called A Broadside, and we said, Against America's Concrete. So you'll see the context. The grand experiment was to destroy my consciousness, bury my thoughts beneath the ocean, and dry out my memory in the southern heat. See, every time we write, we have to become smart about something. So to write those two lines, you have to know something about your history. And I wanted them to understand that. Don't just write these feel-good pieces. Teach us something at the same time. But I resisted, and I still resist, to be caricatured, although I'm still on display. To those who want their America back, I'll give it freely if you can give me back what I offered in return. You were my first kiss. My Huffy bicycle, my corner store, my red 10 speed, my embarrassment and my shame. You continue to be my auction block, looking on to see what I will do next. I see you looking over my shoulder, wondering what I will say, wondering, I will not crack, still intact. I am home. Many of our young people are cracking and not intact. So then a young brother wrote, and he was writing to teachers, well, I was writing to the nation. He says, as I lay down to sleep, I see you in my dreams. Dreams of pain, anger, sorrow, death. Why do my dreams torment you so? All our people want to do is be successful, right? There's a song out. I just want to be successful. I don't know how it goes, but it's a hip-hop song. Why do my dreams torment you so? Because you torment me. They're talking about the relationship gaps. In case you didn't know, so be kind to me, or the next time when you die, it won't be in a dream. See? James Melvin Washington, in his book, Conversation with God, wrote, somewhere in the infrastructure of the human soul, there dwells a dormant anger poised to register its complaint about the unfairness of life. That's right. Our kids, if we don't help them recover, become resilient, and recognize different identities, that anger no longer remains dormant. It's expressed. That's why we can not afford not to be hopeful. I'm going to skip that. Because we cannot walk away from what it means to be human when engaging our students, multiple identities with reading and writing. And if we're not experiencing our fullest selves with our young people, then we're not doing something right. We too shall be transformed if we're providing effective and responsive education. Because our destinies are tied up together. Maybe I had 30 slides. I know this is the last one. But I want to share this with you. Because I understand many African Americans are doing extremely well in this society. We have a large, large growing middle class. Right? But we also have those who have been left behind. Some due to their own fault. But some due to other circumstances as well, too. I know there's free and compulsory schooling in the United States. I understand that. But when they show up, are educators ready for them and responsible for them? That's a different orientation, right? So I wrote this, 527. This is a young brother who made it. Received a chess scholarship to go to college. August 10th, he was going to enroll August 28th. He never made it. Oh, next slide. Come on, a pastor. I was like four slides ahead of you. Can you walk and chew gum at the same time? Yes, I can. Yes, I can. Si se puede. All right? I got to remind myself here. So I'll end in here. And this is how our destinies are tied up together. He taught me how to play chess when I was younger. He had a father in his household. To make all the right moves, the rooks, the castles, the pawns, the bishops, I could castle and use my queen to protect myself. All those thoughts flashed in my mind when the car pulled up beside us. It's 12:15 a.m. I'm 18, sitting on the passenger side, nowhere to move, no strategy. I thought about learning chess when I was younger. The young man in the other car lifts his hands, checker hands, tic-tac-toe hands. I was no match for him. I thought my scholarship letter would save me. It was my next move. My buddy screams first. I'm hit next. Checkmate. Game over. We did really well by the chess hands. We didn't do so well by the checker hands and the tic-tac-toe hands. The problem is we can't determine who the chess hands and checker hands beforehand. Because they both appear for us, giving us the same chance. And I could have just said this to wrap up what I want to talk about. It's not just about students' literacies, It's about students' lives. And that's what allows me to remain steadfast. And thank you for giving me an opportunity to share my thoughts with you this evening.
Thank you very much. All right, thank you. Thank you.